To begin, actually, by reading a couple of verses from the 8th Psalm, if you want to turn over there to Psalm 8, and then if you want to put your bookmark over in Hebrews chapter 11, that'll be where we go from there. So it's good to see you this morning. We welcome those of you that are visiting with us. Trust that our study this morning will be of some profit to you, and want you to feel welcome to come back and be with us whenever you have the opportunity. In the 8th Psalm, beginning of verse 3, David says, "When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars that you have ordained, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you visit him?" Mark and I and a friend of ours from Minneapolis spent Monday this past week just outside of San Angelo quail hunting. It's pretty rugged country, and it's out kind of San Angelo proper's not in the middle of nowhere. Actually, San Angelo proper is in the middle of nowhere, but we were out of San Angelo, really in the middle of nowhere. And as the sun set that evening, and we were working our way up this rocky hillside, chasing the dogs up the hill, and the colors in the sky in that part of the world are pretty majestic, and the sky became on the horizon orange and pinks and blues and purples, and it was hard to think about hunting and not just stand there and watch it as the colors began to subside and fade into night. And we went back to the ranch house and took care of some details and took care of the dogs, and everybody kind of started cleaning up, and I sat down outside the house, propped myself up in a chair and kicked my legs back and just started watching the sky. You don't get to do that around here. I mean, you can, and you think, well, I can see a lot of stars at my house. No, you can't. Not like you can there. And I sat there for, I don't know, an hour and watched shooting stars fly over, and the clouds kind of come and go, and those words that I just read were what struck me. You know, what I sat there and watched was the same thing that David sat there and watched thousands of years ago. Same star, same sky, different part of the world, but eventually, as the world turned, we would all be looking at the same thing. And you know, here's a man that grows up as a shepherd. Who knows how many times he laid out on a hillside, not unlike where I was. And as the sheep are settled in for the evening, and he starts looking up and beholding the skies. How many times he looked at those same stars and thought, "Who in the world am I? And why in the world would God pay any attention to me?" I believe in God. One of the fundamental qualities of Christianity, which is what we're working on this year, is the idea of fundamental Christianity. According to Hebrews chapter 6, when the Hebrew writer writes to those Christians and lists these fundamental things, these first principles of Christianity, That these people are going to have to go back and look at, even though they should have advanced far beyond them. One of the things he lists is faith in God. Now, I'm not sure when he says that in that context, he necessarily means the idea of believing that God exists as much as he believes the concept of putting your confidence in God. But in either case, as we look at our memory verse in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 6, he's going to go on to note that without faith, without this trust in God, it's impossible to believe Him. And the one who comes to God first has to believe that He exists. That this idea that God exists and that He's out there is very fundamental to what we accept as Christians. And so this morning, I want to talk about this a little bit. This is what we're trying to kind of focus on through the month. And we've already introduced the idea in some ways. We've talked about our attitudes, about honesty in regards to evidence several times on Wednesdays. And we've mentioned a couple of these principles as we have kind of introduced not only the theme for the year, but as we've gone into this self-examination kind of thinking that we've been talking about in regards to spiritual growth. And so I want to spend a few minutes this morning. I will tell you at the outset, I'm going to try to do the best I can to have this thing done as quickly as possible. This is not a topic, folks, that you can just in 15 minutes talk about. So please understand that at the outset. There are aspects of our confidence and our faith and our worldview that just demand a little more time. So I'm going to be as brief as possible, but I do want to introduce the subject. And let me also say, in regards to what we're about to study, I'm a Bible teacher. If you ask me what I do, I would say, well, I teach the Bible. I will help you understand what God's Word says. I'm not a scientist. I am not the smartest man in town. And I read an article yesterday about some guy that had written that they had finally proven the evolution of mankind. And the entire article was about genetics and amino acids and peptides and the genetic comparison between human beings, hominoids, and the great apes and the chimpanzees, and how on a fundamental scale that we are so closely related to this one, so closely related to that one, and that all proves that evolution is true. And by the time I finished that, I didn't understand a word of what I had just read. So I want you to understand, I'm not approaching this from the perspective of some geneticist, but I want you to understand this at the outset. I think we buy into a bunch of baloney when we think that we can't defend our faith because we're not smart enough to argue with someone who is a geneticist. I tell you what I have learned about people in that capacity. They're just like everybody else. They believe what they want to believe. And so I want to kind of take this approach that's not necessarily a proving the Bible by the Bible approach. I want to look at the idea of the concept of believing in God. And what I want you to notice at the very outset of that is, as man entertains the question, and man's always entertained the question, does God really exist? If you go to Genesis chapter 1, in the beginning was the Word. That's John chapter 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That the Bible assumes the existence of God. I mean, if you're going to study the Bible, say, well, I'm a Christian, I believe in God. Why do you believe in God? Well, the fundamental answer is because the Bible says God exists. Starts off with that. Well, let me tell you, if you talk to someone who doesn't believe in God, that's probably not going to hold a lot of water. And that makes it difficult for us because we are living in an age where the idea of God is losing ground. And yet, it is very fundamental to our belief system, our worldview, that there is an omniscient, omnipotent being, and that He's out there, and that He's created everything. And not only has He created everything physically, but He has revealed Himself, and He has made demands of us, and there is a moral, spiritual dilemma that we're dealing with in life, and that's why the world is the way it is. The idea of belief in God is fundamental to who we are. You can't chunk that and be a Christian. And yet, what do you do with someone who doesn't believe? According to the Gallup poll that was taken last year in May, in the United States of America, 87% of the people in this country believe in God. And you think, man, that's pretty good. Well, in the last generation, 50 years or so, that's dropped from almost 100%. And it continues to drop because I suspect that you have to factor into those statistics that there's a lot of older folks that are going to be a part of that poll. The poll does not break down generationally how many people above the age of 30 believe in God as opposed to how many people below the age of 30. But if I was a gambling man and I was going to put money on it, I would say that the poll is skewed by the older generation. That there is much less belief among younger generations. And I tell you part of the reason I believe that. The poll does break down this. There are follow-up questions to the, do you believe in God? First follow-up question is, are you convinced that God exists? That drops down to 64%. That's pretty substantial. That means only 6 out of 10 people are absolutely convinced. And then the next question was, do you believe in God but have a little doubt? 16% believe in God, but they grapple with that. And then, do you have a lot of doubt? 5% believe in God, but they're not really sure that they believe in God. And that's interesting to me. In 2005, 12 years ago, 80% were absolutely convinced. 8% had a little doubt. 3% had a lot of doubt. Now what that says to us, folks, is we are living in a world that increasingly has dismissed the concept of God. And I think a lot of what's happening in our society reflects that. And I was sitting at a soccer game yesterday and watching a little girl from an opposing team who was fouling repeatedly. The ref called her over and she turned around and walked away while the ref was talking to her. And the ref had to walk behind her and call her back over and reprimand her. And then she just turned her back and walked off to him again. And the parents are over here cheering the girl and the coach is over commending the girl. And I mentioned to one of the other parents, you know, part of what we're seeing in our society is a reflection of that right there. Because there is this sense anymore that I don't have to listen to you. I can get ahead by cheating and lying and stealing. The rules are not there, and I don't have to be amenable to them. And whatever I can do to win is what I'm going to do. And then that person graduates from high school and goes off to college with the same mentality. And then that person becomes a part of a wage-earning society with that same mentality, and that lying and cheating and stealing and not being amenable to anyone else causes this kind of disruption. And you want to know what that all indicates? It indicates that there is a mindset in our world that says, I'm not accountable. And while a person may tell you they believe in God, if they deny the concept of accountability, then doubt and paganism and immorality and temporality and gender confusion and lack of gender roles and materialism and hedonism and subjectivism and selfishness is going to reign. And it's going to reign supreme. If you've got your bookmark in Hebrews chapter 11, if you'll flip over very quickly to Romans chapter 1. That is essentially the argument that Paul makes, that when we dismiss God, we just become a people that are little more than animals. And starting in verse 18, he says, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress truth. And notice that the Bible proposes that this existence of God and accountability of God is truth. Who suppress truth and unrighteousness, because what may be known of God is made known to them. God has shown it to them since the creation of the world. His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. But because although they knew God, they did not glorify Him as a God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. And as you read through the remainder of the chapter, it ends beginning in verse 29 with this laundry list of ungodliness, being filled with unrighteousness and sexual immorality and wickedness and covetousness, maliciousness, envy, murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness, whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving, unforgiving, unmerciful. That's the world we live in. And it's the world we live in increasingly because of those statistics up there. Because when you dismiss God, we just become the animals that the scientists say that we are. Now, we talked a little bit this morning about works that we're supposed to be doing as we grow spiritually. One of which is we need to be prepared. We need to be prepared to defend what we believe. We need to be prepared to teach our children. Our children are growing up in a society that advances this kind of doubt of God and skepticism. It is what sociologists would call a postmodern world that we're living in. And that's what they're growing up in, and that's what they see as the norm. Are you prepared to teach them? Are you prepared to try to influence your neighbors out here, as David was talking about the power of influence? Are you prepared? So, if we're Christians and we have to believe that God is, and that's part of our faith, let's talk for the remainder of our time a little bit about some things we can do to advocate and advance this idea of believing in God. And I want to begin by making an observation. And the observation is that belief in God and not belief in God, the existence of God, is, regardless of which side you come down on it, an issue of faith. And you say, well, yeah, that's what we're talking about. No, I have made this observation before and had people come up angry with me at the end of the sermon. But belief is, and I'm using the term in regards to the concept of not trust, but belief. But belief is confidence in the truth or existence of something that's not immediately susceptible to rigorous proof. In other words, I can't use empirical evidence to prove it. I can't taste it. I can't touch it. I can't smell it. I can't see it. I can't hear it. I can't use my senses. And when we get beyond empirical proof, we have a real difficulty with things. Now, the Hebrew writer also addresses this, where in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 1, he says, faith is the substance, though that which stands under the foundation, the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. I mean, God's not foolish, folks. God understands that this is the way that it is, that you can't prove that God exists. That's the statement that always gets me in trouble with somebody. Somebody comes up and says, yes, I can. And my response is, no, you can't. And then they go, yes, I can. And I go, no, you can't. And then they really get frustrated. And then finally when I say, okay, prove it, I just want to go, see there? But that doesn't take you anywhere. I want you to understand that if you could prove beyond a shadow of a doubt empirically that God existed, we wouldn't be having this discussion in 2017. I mean, people have been kicking this idea around for centuries, folks, and we are not. I know we've got Apple phones that we can't operate and that the 10's better than the 8, 8's better than 7, 7's better than 6 because they slowed the 6 down. I get all that. I don't understand any of it. But that doesn't mean that I'm smarter than the guys that built the pyramids. We can't figure out how they did that yet. You know, men are pretty sharp and they've been discussing and debating the existence of God for thousands of years. At this point, we would have figured it out if we could prove it, or if we could prove He didn't exist. And yet we're still debating it, and what that helps us to understand is that belief in God is an issue of belief. It is an issue of considering evidence and drawing conclusions from it. I mean, you look at that podium, and it's sitting inside of a building, and just common sense says, well, you know, there's some design in the way that thing was built, and it's made to be fairly functional, and it is aesthetically, I guess, pleasing to some people. And you look at that and you think, you know, common sense tells me that somebody probably built that thing. And we reason that way. We reason that way all the time. Constantly we are taking evidence and analyzing it. But I tell you what is absolutely vital if we're going to produce the kind of trust in people that draws the conclusion that, yeah, okay, I think God does exist. Look on the screen. You have to be honest with evidence. I mentioned a while ago that the scientists that you sometimes read after are not always intellectually honest. There are some scientific principles that even a commoner can understand that have yet to have been solved by those who are of a natural concept about the origin of the universe and about evolution. You know, okay, we can argue about DNA and amino acids and the various and sundry chemicals that make that up. Where did all that come from? You know, at some point you got to deal with the eternal existence of matter. You have to deal with where did the energy come from. You have to deal with the fact that something came from nothing or something was always there. You have to deal with the fact that even science has proven that life doesn't come from non-life. And there are principles that have to be addressed that common sense demands, and everybody has their loopholes. And if we're not careful, we'll be dishonest too. So honesty is absolutely important. And I'll tell you something else that affects us. It's what we want. If you don't want to be accountable to God, you're going to find a way to deal with that conscientiously. Desire makes a difference. Prejudice makes a difference. If you grew up in a home where Christianity and the belief in God was seen as just the pablum of a bunch of hypocrites who can't deal with life, then the chances are that mindset that you grew up hearing is something that you're going to have to deal with if you're going to address the concept of whether God exists and whether Christianity is worth my consideration. Consequences. Jesus is constantly testing the Pharisees about their honesty about evidence. And at least on one occasion, we are told when they asked Jesus where his authority came from, and Jesus says, well, what about John the Baptist's authority? Where did it come from? And they begin to reason from consequences. Well, if we say this, they're not questioning where do we think he came from. Their question is, if we say this, we're going to have this consequence, and if we say this, we're going to have that consequence. And so their answer is, well, we don't know. They're not interested in truth. And I'm going to tell you, that's a challenge for us. It's a challenge for everybody. What's the consequences if I believe in God or if I reject belief in God? Our background makes a difference. Our ability to understand makes a difference. Ed Harrell has been with us a couple of times. He made a statement years ago that has stuck in my mind. He was studying something with someone. He may have told this here. I don't remember. He was studying something with someone, and he made a, according to him, he made a just an airtight argument. And the guy said, I don't get that. So Ed said, I backed up, and I came in from another angle and made just an airtight argument. The guy said, I just don't see that. And he said, well, I backed up a third time and came in from another direction, made an airtight argument. The guy said, I just don't get it. And he said, I sat there for a while, looked at him, and I finally figured out what the problem was. He didn't get it. Well, you know, sometimes there are elements of evidence that we are incapable of fully understanding. And you've got to be honest about that, too. But ultimately, here's the challenge. And this is my discovery, and you live long enough, I think you'll agree with it. People believe what they want to believe. And you can make a pretty good argument to your children, to your family, to your coworkers, to the people you have a discussion with about your faith. You can make some pretty good arguments, and they may not be able to answer them, but one of the frustrations in dealing with people is, at the end of the day, we do what we want to do. And I'm convinced that's the problem most of the time. Whether you're talking about dealing with self-analysis in a local congregation and how do we grow, well, at the end of the day, I'm going to do what I want to do. If I don't want to grow, if I don't want to make more sacrifices, if I don't want to work harder, if I don't want to be here more, if I don't want to become more godly, if I don't want to do those things, I'm not going to do them. And I'm going to find a way to rationalize that in my head where I'm comfortable with that. Human beings are good at that. Ultimately, that's what we are going to deal with. And since we can't prove that God exists, the question then arises, well, what do I do with that? How do I help somebody believe? How do I strengthen my own conviction? And once again, I think what you end up having to do is you have to provide some evidence, and then you have to make sure that believing in God is more reasonable than not believing in God. And I tell you, I think that's where everybody is. No matter how strong their faith is, ultimately, they'll look around at the world and say, it is more reasonable to me to look at this world and the way everything is and to believe that there is a God behind it than to believe it all came about by chance and circumstance for a lot of reasons. And that is, I think, the crux of the issue with us when it comes to talking to people who don't believe in God. And it's tempting just to walk away and not even bother with it. But I know people, and you probably do too, who used to be agnostic, maybe even used to be an avowed atheist. And actually, literature is full of people who have written that said, for years, I did not believe in God, and this is what finally convinced me. We can do this, okay? And so let me offer you, secondly, a few things to consider to start with. And the first is, because this is kind of where we start with everything, because we are Bible believers, is there a biblical argument for the existence of God? And I understand that you can't take the Bible to prove God, and yet the Bible's a pretty powerful evidence of the existence of God in several ways. The one I do want you to appreciate is where we started. In the 19th Psalm, and I would ask you to turn there because I do want to read. Julian's already read this for us, but I want you to consider it again. In the 19th Psalm, and the Scriptures are full of this mindset, of this kind of observation. David says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork." Now, that means you look up in the sky and you see the sun and the moon and the stars. You know, that's pretty compelling. That didn't just happen. And then the firmament, whether you want to look at the firmament in regards to the sky, which it's used that way sometimes, whether you want to look at it as the solar system, at times firmament's actually used of the earth itself. No matter where you look, I think, is a kind of what David is saying. No matter where you look, it shows the wisdom and the glory of God. Day unto day utters speech, night unto night reveals knowledge. In other words, the world is talking to us. There's no speech or language where their voice is not heard. Doesn't matter if you're in China, if you're in Korea, if you're in South Africa, if you're in Venezuela, if you're in Canada, if you're in Australia, the skies are all the same. You see the same stuff. There's nowhere that their voice is not heard. Their line has gone through all the earth. Their words to the end of the world. He has set in them, that is in the heavens, a tabernacle for the sun. And this is an interesting description, a tent. And it addresses the idea that, you know, were it not for our scientific advancement, we wouldn't really necessarily know where the sun comes from and where it goes. And so David's picturing this in his mind. There's some place the sun goes. God, there's a tabernacle. It exists somewhere, and it comes out in the morning. And it's like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber. Who's not overwhelmed by the sunrise? Like a bridegroom coming out of a chamber. Or a rejoices like a strong man running his race. The rising's from one end of the heaven, and it's circuit all the way to the other end, and everybody is exposed to the effects of such. And you can go to Job chapter 38 through 42, where God tells Job, when Job is questioning the justice of God, and God begins saying, you tell me where you were when I created a snowflake. You tell me where you were when I made ice what it is. You tell me where you were when I told the ocean you can come this far but not any farther. You tell me where you were when I created the animal. You tell me why things are the way they are, if it doesn't argue that I am who I am. And I will tell you, folks, when we talk to people about our conviction, don't be afraid to say, yeah, I believe in God and I believe in the Bible. And the scoffing and the ridicule may happen, but I'm going to tell you, the Bible accounts for a lot of things. Why is there order in the universe? Why can we map out the stars and know that a comet's coming back in 137 years and there won't be a blue supermoon again until a particular date 4 years from now? Why is that? Well, why is it that there's beauty? Why is it that there's morality? Why is it that there is sexuality? You know, it's always interesting to me. I loved biology. I started off college to be a veterinarian, studied a lot of that stuff. You know, single-celled, self-replicating organisms don't somewhere down the line decide, hey, it would be more fun if we would have two different ones and have sexual relations in order to produce the next generation. You know, where does that come from? How did that develop? Oh, and I'm sure there's all kinds of answers, but there's all kinds of questions as well. God accounts for those things. He accounts for the differences. He accounts for why we are the way we are, for the design of mankind, for the nobility of mankind, for the fact that we believe in things that, you know, Haley's got a little dog that's living with us. And she will come and sit in front of my chair and stare at me. And I ask her, stupid that I am, what do you want? As if I think she's going to answer me. And I know my intelligent mind knows that she doesn't know what she wants. She's not looking at me going, I'd like for you to go over there, open that bread basket, take that bread out, undo that little wrapper thing on the end, make me a peanut butter sandwich. She's not thinking that way. I have no idea why she's looking at me. She can't think beyond her design. But you and I can have the conversation we just had about why she is the way she is. Isn't that interesting? And as you go through the Bible, that argument's made. Paul makes the argument in Romans chapter 8 that we just read. In Lystra, Paul makes the argument again that you look at the world around, you look at the fruitful seasons, you look at the goodness, and that argues the existence of someone greater. Or especially in Acts chapter 17, among all of those idolaters, where he declares the unknown God and says, in Him we live and move and have our very being, and we grope after Him and we seek after Him. And your own poets acknowledge that reality. Where does that come from? Well, at least the biblical proposition about creation answers those questions. But what about those who just want to reject that? Well, here are some what are referred to as classical arguments. They were actually labeled and kind of proposed in a formal way by a guy named Thomas Aquinas in around 1200, 1225, 1250 A.D., but they are arguments that men have been discussing forever. And you don't have to know the big, long, fancy names. The reality is these are the kind of arguments we make to people all the time. Well, why do you believe in God? Well, you know, I'm not even sure you could think about God if it weren't for the fact of God's revelation. We're not very good. We think we're pretty imaginative people. And you look at any science fiction or anything else, we just take what we've got here and project it out and change it a little bit and put a fin on it or big eyes and we think we've come up with something new. No, we're not very good. In fact, we're not able to conceive of what is beyond us. And one of the arguments, it's kind of a philosophical argument, is that mankind does not have the capability outside of outside influence to consider the very concept of God or the very concept of perfection. And that is not the strongest of the classical arguments, but it is nonetheless something worth consideration that there aren't very easy answers to. What is a stronger argument is what's generally referred to as the general argument, and that is as long as we have record of mankind on the earth, you go find some lost tribe in the middle of the Amazon, if they're still out there, and the reality is they probably have some concept of a being greater than themselves. Where did that come from? Well, you and I would argue, well, the biblical argument is that we all came from a single source and that through the consciousness of society, we remember that there is a God. And that's a pretty powerful argument. There is what we have already discussed in some slight way, what's referred to as the cosmological argument. And that says everything has some cause. No matter what's in our existence in this world, everything that is, it came from something else. And there's no new uncaused matter or energy or activity throughout the universe. A scientifically verifiable fact, at least with the resources that we have. And so if matter were eternal, I mean, there's just all kinds of arguments that go to this end. Then you would find it in some ways, and other things wouldn't happen. And the reality is, everything's got to have a source, a cause, and that's a hard part that evolutionists and those who dismiss God have to deal with. That something is eternal. Either matter is eternal and energy is eternal, or there's a personal God that is eternal. And folks, we have these discussions with people. Now we don't necessarily go, let me run the cosmological argument up on you, okay? But this is common sense stuff. We ask it all the time. Somebody says, well, you know, the Big Bang. Where did all that stuff come from that blew up? You don't have to have a scientific grasp of the Big Bang theory to make that argument. These are the arguments that we make, and these are the arguments that we need to make with folks. There is the teleological argument that we've already made, that the Bible makes. There is design and order in this world. You see it in everything around us, that it is made in a certain way, and it's very reflective of the fact that something had to make it that way. It is the argument that you very often will hear illustrated by the watchmaker. Have you ever heard anybody make the watchmaker argument? Okay, you open up this watch and it measures time. And you open it up and, man, there's all kinds of stuff in there, you know. Chances are pretty good you're not going to tackle repairing your watch. And then the argument is, do you think that just happened by chance? Oh, no, there's like 300 little parts in there and springs and all kinds of, okay. Do you know how many parts there are in the universe that operates in a very consistent way like your watch does? That's a powerful argument. And then there is what I think is perhaps the strongest argument. It is not an argument that looks at the universe per se. It is almost completely an argument that is philosophical. Everybody's got a sense of right or wrong. I don't care how atheistic you may be, you got a sense of right or wrong. And if you don't think that's true, if you're an atheist, and you can try this on somebody. If they're an atheist, step on their toe. I don't believe in God. Hey, you shouldn't have done that. Why do you think I shouldn't have done that? Well, that's not right. It's not right. Where did the very concept come from? What if I think it's right? You know, I'm going to tell you, folks, that's a hard thing for people to grapple with. Because even people who will say, I just don't believe all this moral stuff. Sexuality is just, and people make an argument about sex in our society all the time. Homosexuality, open marriage, gender confusion, all the time. Well, you can't tell me that's wrong. Come over here and let me step on your toe. The reality is, some way or another, we have this sense that there are things that are right and there are things that are wrong. And then the last of what's very often called the classical arguments is, just look around. If you're not impressed by that sunset, well, why is it that we are? Revit, my dog, he's running up the hillside, being a dog. He's not stopping and going, wow. Check that out. In fact, I hollered over at Barker's. Hey, did you check out this guy? You know, my dog wasn't hollering at Rob's dog going, hey, Leroy, check out this guy. Why is it that there's an explanation for those things, the very fundamental existences of life. And so when you talk to people, when you deal with people, when your kids come home and say, this is what they taught us in science class, I'm going to tell you, folks, these are the kinds of things we need to be having discussions with our children about. Which leads me to the last observation. And that is, the reason that I believe in God is because I just have a hard time accepting that life has no meaning. That life has no purpose. And you can say, well, you were raised by Christians, and so you wouldn't think any other way. Well, you know, my own experience at this point in my life, I'm 55, I'm on the backside, I'm rolling downhill. And I look at my family, I look at my friends, I look at the material world, I look at the temporal aspect, I look at the things that are temptations, I see the works of the flesh. And you take all that into consideration, and the idea that it's meaningless when there is so much meaning to be found in so many things, that just doesn't jee-haw with me. That's not evidence that seems to me that says, just dismiss this idea of God. And I will tell you something that I think we need to address to people who don't believe in God. And that is, aren't you miserable? Atheism or agnosticism, which is just the idea of doubt gone to seed, they are worldviews that are rooted in doubt. They question everything. They provide answers for nothing. And I must tell you that even people who believe in macroevolution, evolution among the species, they have a hard time answering a lot of questions, and life is pretty unsatisfactory, mainly because of all those moral issues. They're walking around with a sore toe because you stomped on their toe, and the whole time they're thinking, I don't like that guy anymore because he stomped on my toe and he shouldn't have done that, and yet they don't have an answer for that. And I tell you, I know a couple of people who are avowed non-believers in God. And you want to know where they get their joy? They get their joy in relationships. In relationships with people who are believers. Because the believers find joy in life. They find purpose in life. They find meaning in life. The people I know that are atheists, they're not out on the street finding the most ungodly person they can find to have some kind of relationship with, because that ungodly person is eventually going to step on their toe too and do other things as well. It is a life that leads to cynicism and anarchy and despair. And just once, I'd love for somebody in a debate to stand up to an atheist and say, I tell you what, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to kill your family, I'm going to shoot your dog, I'm going to do all kinds of things to you and put you out of your misery. Would that be okay? And if they're consistent with their worldview, they would go, yeah, man, because there is no pleasure in this life. But I tell you something that's in our favor that we need to appreciate, and that is that belief in God provides some meaning, some hope. Yeah, I think the world is a place that's got its ungodliness and its evil. And that's very often one of the arguments that'll be made. If you believe in God, tell me where evil came from. Well, I think there's a biblical answer for that, that God made us in His image, that we are moral creatures with our own free will. And that's one of the things that separates us from the chimpanzees that we're supposed to be so close to in regards to our DNA. And the reality is, I can do whatever it is that I want to do. And I can do right and I can do wrong. And I can have some purpose in my life and I can know where I'm going. And I can believe that there is a world that's better than this because God tells me that it's there. Where does that hope come from if it's not from God? People say, well, that's a pie-in-the-sky mentality. It used to offend me. Now I just go, yeah, that's right. It is. Because I just don't find much in this life that's worth hanging on to. But belief in God provides us the answers that we need. It provides us the hope in life that says it is worth living and that I can be more than I am and that the world has great potential and that mankind is not a lost cause. We live in a world of doubt, folks, and belief in God is one of those issues that we have to reason through with people. And you may not convince them. We may not convince them for a lot of reasons. We may not convince them because of their honesty or their understanding or their prejudice or their traditions or... But mainly, if you don't convince them, it's just going to be because they don't want it. Because belief always is an act of will, and our desire is what finally drives our will. But we got to grapple with it. You've got to grapple with it. If you're not a Christian, you've got to grapple with this. Because if it's true, then you're accountable. And in my opinion, that's what is the bottom line with most folks. If I believe in God, I'm accountable. And so as we begin this year, this is where you have to start with folks. This is what the Hebrew writer said. He that comes to God must believe that he is. And we have to be honest in that consideration, and that is very important. And we need to challenge people with that in our day and age, because fundamental Christianity begins there. That we were created in the image and likeness of God. And that we didn't do very well with the creation that we have. And here we find ourselves, because of our moral being, frustrated with who we ought to be as opposed to who we are. Mark asked this morning in class, does your conscience ever bother you about this, that, and the other? Why do you even have one? We got to grapple with that. And we do, and God has supplied an answer to that. And the answer is that we can be like God again. And that's where Christianity comes in. And all that God has designed through the years is to deal with that problem of sin so that we can be the people we're supposed to be again. That's what real spiritual growth is. I'm going to be like the God who created me again. And this is where we start. All right, I appreciate your attention. I know that was longer than normal. I hope it'll give you some things to think about. I must tell you, we didn't touch the hem of the garment. But folks, if we're going to stand up for what we believe, it is a garment that we have to deal with. So I hope that will help you. Thanks so much. If you are subject to the invitation, if you need to profess your faith in God and be baptized for the remission of your sins, we invite your response while we stand and sing.